So this is the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center, and it is November 6, 2015, and I am here with David Adamczyk, a local violinist and composer who has been involved in many different aspects of the Buffalo art scene. So David, thank you very much for coming in today and meeting with me.
Very glad to be here.
So I have to say that primarily with these interviews, I interview visual artists and have just interviewed a few musicians and composers, such as Jan Williams and Junie Booth. So you're part of a much smaller group in that way. So you'll have to work with me a little more in some of the descriptions you offer of the nuances of what you do and how we talk about that. Full disclosure, David and I are friends, and in the past when I've interviewed musicians, I've actually gone to David for insight into questions I should ask. And so this is a very unique situation for me as well. So the first question I ask in these interviews is, what inspired you to want to be an artist? What inspired you to want to be a musician?
Well, it's a very big question. It comes in a number of phases. I guess I should say I started out playing violin at age 4, and pretty soon after learned that I had some kind of proficiency with the instrument. I had a good ear, and that brought me a ways, and I started lessons at an early age. And I guess at first it was more like an activity to me. You know, when you're a kid and you're good at something, that's enough. And through time, I started to learn that I had more interest in composing as well. So I started doing that around, I think, second grade. So I've always kind of had multiple interests in that sense, and I'd say when I was more around adolescence, I started to play and get a kind of it was akin to therapy. It would always be there for me when I needed it. And it was sometimes my best friend, and that relationship grew until I started to realize that I had my own ideas, and that there was something beyond that, and I kept exploring the many different aspects of music that I enjoyed. And trying to bring these things together, and I guess at a certain point I realized I did have my own take on things that I had never heard before, that I wanted to hear, things I'd imagine, and all of these bits and pieces were parts of me, and how they connected I didn't know, and to a large extent I still don't know, but I at some point, I think it was a New Year's resolution, I said to myself, you know, to respect yourself as an artist and what you need in that respect. And there wasn't any one point where I knew I was an artist or decided to be an artist. It's just the result of it being my primary preoccupation, looking for a way to make it my occupation. So,
David, where did you go to school? And this can be both college or before college, you know, how did that influence you as a musician?
Well, I grew up taking lessons, so I guess start there. The Suzuki program teaches young kids from ages of 3 to 4, I guess, on. So that was my beginning, and I went through a lot of summer training programs, a lot of immersion trips to different countries to perform, and those were all really informative and eye-opening. I sought out lessons for composition in, I think, the 10th grade, when I started to need more direction, because I had ideas in my head that I couldn't get out yet. So I found a doctoral candidate at UB, and she was my first real composition teacher. She opened my eyes to all sorts of things.
What was her name?
Adrienne Elisha. And she introduced me to who would be my teacher eventually in school, Nils Vigeland, a student and a friend of Morten Feldman. And so I auditioned for violin and composition at a number of the big schools that I wanted to go to. Manhattan School of Music ended up being my choice, where Nils was on the faculty. New York was a place I'd dreamed about growing up in the suburbs around Buffalo, and once I was there, I was often dreaming of Buffalo. But I got a lot out of my lessons, and to experience what it is to be at a school full of people doing what you're trying to do, and taking in the traditions. And it was I don't regret it, but I found that I got really what informed my own work out of the libraries and other things going on around the city, and so I'd say I got a lot out of school, but it wasn't necessarily what crafted me into the composer I'd become, or was already on my way to becoming. And felt kind of at odds with a lot of the music, with the atmosphere. I found that it's difficult to create art in a vacuum.
Can you speak a little bit about working with Nils and sort of that tradition that you were with him?
Sure. Nils is just fantastic. He is the type who looks for the things that you're not so sure about, or territories that you are unfamiliar with, or tries to locate the things that you do like to write, and asks you to do completely different things. In my experience, he really broke me down and built me back up. He'd always look for those specific questions: what about your music reflects your experience of what life is like, and things like. Things like that, and there was a point at which I couldn't write a note for about a year, just because I was questioning what is it to write a note? What's the meaning behind the note? Do I own this note? Is this and where does the piece come from? As a result of the first note I write. And I had been writing really expressive, in very intense emotional music, and it got to a point where he asked me, is it emotional because it expresses emotion, or is there more to expression than just heavy vibrato or minor chords and things like that? And it really turned my experience around, and I started to see the expression within all sorts of different systems of approaching a piece of music. And I started to, it really opened up my mind to what a piece could be built on, what drives a piece of music, and I have been and continue to explore the many ways that music can work, that can music can come to be what drives it. So I owe a lot of that to Nils, although those were already kind of strands in my writing. So
you mentioned that Nils was, you know, close with Morton Feldman, who was part of the new music sort of school, mm-hmm. in Buffalo, sort of during the heyday of June in Buffalo, and those sorts of influences. Was that influential?
It was, yes. In high school, when I was taking lessons with Adrian, I spent much of my time in that music library. It's a vast resource, and I got to know Feldman's writing as well as different composers. There's just such a wealth of different kinds of music, and Feldman's is particularly poignant. The extreme economy of the notes that he'd use, of the majority of what he write is very soft, very slow, but highly expressive, and in a different way than music that I'd write or that I'd heard, as far as expression. And I started to understand how music could be listened to in many different ways, and that a lot of where musical thought was coming from was in finding different ways to listen. If you listen to Philip Glass with the same ears that you listen to Beethoven, it's going to be really boring. But once you make that change, all sorts of things open up, and you get parts of that in hearing sounds outside as musical. And I'd always been a fan of many different kinds of musics that seemed to have nothing to do with each other. And I always wondered, you know, why is that? What is my voice when I like so many different kinds of music? And learned from that experience that doesn't need to be a question that's answered, that your own voice can emerge from many different places.
Well, I feel like we've kind of touched on this a little, but can you speak more about some of your more important influences, both in the form of mentors or musicians or recordings?
Sure. Well, my influences are all over the place, and I do have a few composers who really shook my musical world, and I'd say during the years where Napster was a thing, and you could get pretty much whatever you wanted. Most things were mislabeled, and never really knew what you were listening to. I stumbled across the music of this Russian composer who was writing tone mass music. I knew nothing about this, but I was, I think it was probably 13 or 14, I was listening to things like heavy metal and singer-songwriters and whatever, and in particular, there was that unexpected link between the heaviness of the heavy metal music that I was listening to, and then I listened to something like Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, with just huge blocks of sound, and realized that, you know, no one music owns these affects, and it really made me realize that the violin that I had studied and all this classical music that I had learned, which I couldn't really relate to a lot of the other kinds of music I enjoyed, that there was some kind of connection, and I said, this is really for me. And I think that's when I started to want to have lessons. Fell in love with the music of Bartok pretty early on, the way that he could get people's heads bobbing in the theater with his rhythmic writing, and while still having a very modern bent to it. It was fascinating to me. The music of Ligeti, who writes just clouds of sound and takes traditional forms and makes something just completely new out of them, very fresh and very poignant and direct, regardless of how complex he was writing. The music of Xenakis also was huge for me. It was a kind of musical language that I could hear and appreciate before I understood anything about it, and I still don't quite understand what he was going for, but the complexity of the music and the way that I know it was constructed seemed to have a totally different manifestation when it was heard. Almost sounded wild and visceral, and little did I know it was highly mathematically constructed. So to see the difference between how it's constructed and how it comes across was a big thing for me. And it got me listening to a lot of music that I wasn't sure I understood, but I knew there was some kind of intelligence and some kind of there was something there to listen into. It wasn't until later that I started to listen to the whole world of jazz and improvised music. It was a big thing for me when I left school to come to Buffalo and hear musicians at Hall Walls and places like that. Even at Nietzsche's, and actually there are many different places throughout Buffalo that had an interest in sound and noise music, and to hear people improvise with the sounds that I'd spent so much time trying to write down was very eye-opening for me.
This makes me think of something I'd like you to touch on a little bit more, which is your relationship as a classically trained musician with improvisation, and how that's influenced your development.
Mm-hmm. Growing up classically trained, I had pretty much no exposure to improvised music, and just didn't enter my world really until I think the first year in school. I met another violin student who was also had his own questions about the way things worked, and in music school there were many kids at music school in the classical department who wouldn't listen to anything written past 1890, and it was difficult to relate to a lot of that. And I think we just got together one day and locked ourselves in a practice room, turned on the microphone, and said the only rule is whatever sound you make is a part of this sound, and we improvised, and I think that was probably the first time I really attempted to do that. I went to school surrounded by jazz musicians, great jazz musicians, and I guess it just to find the in. Once again, you know, there are many worlds in music, and they seem all encompassing. Then you step outside them, find there's many many universes, and it wasn't until I was out of school that I really caught the jazz bug and really wanted to learn how to relate to my instrument in that way, and to improvise in a sense seemed to me to be another form of composing, and composing in the moment. And I'm still trying to find ways of practicing now that I want to start making up music as I go along. I've kind of lost all of the ways of practicing that I've learned over the years of playing written music. So it's fascinating. It's challenging. It's a whole different part of the brain, and I'm still learning. Always learning. So.
Would you say that the environment you found in Buffalo was conducive to learning that?
Yes. I think that Buffalo is unique from the places I've been, in that it doesn't seem to have any one kind of style. There's such a wealth of different musical ideas, and a lot of self-taught musicians, a lot of different vernaculars, and to play with these artists, and I decided one of my goals would be to play with anyone I met. I'd like to think that as a musician I can play with any other musician, and I think that really pushed me to developing my own voice as far as an improviser, and I think there are many different ways to go about it. I'm still just cracking open a lot of the different territories that improvisation can entail, and playing with the in-betweens of somewhat written music, but not completely composed. So.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, we've touched on this in a couple of different ways, but and when I talk, so again, these interviews are the questions I ask are predisposed to visual artists. So my next question that I normally ask is, please talk about your art, what you create, and why you create it. And so I think I'd like to rephrase that and say, talk about your art, but talk about your craft, and what you create, why you create it, and sort of the intentionality or not there.
So I think when I my art comes from a kind of convergence of different themes going on in my life at any given time. I think I'll have the seed of an idea and just sit on it for a while until I can find the thing that goes into it. I'll learn all about the instrument if I'm thinking about writing for an instrument, or about the approach. I have boxes and boxes and boxes of different kinds of research, writing I've done, things I've annotated, and I'm always going back to these and consulting my boxes, and sometimes the idea will come really quickly, but there are many different parts of writing a piece of music and what a piece of music is made out of, and I like to be open to all the different ways that it can manifest. I'm constantly looking for ways I didn't know music could work, and I don't think I'd write a piece if I thought that something like it existed somewhere else. Like to, you know, hear new things if at all possible. But that's never a motivating factor. It's just kind of when you get into a world, you kind of realize that it's very spacious and there's many ways for it to go that probably haven't experienced before. The way I approach writing has changed over time. I think I started writing very linearly and looking for the end of the piece, learning about how pieces were constructed, and I started to modify my approach. Sometimes it would come from form, sometimes it would come from a certain germ of an idea that would flower out, and other times I'd jump into a piece deliberately not knowing what was going to happen, and kind of in a form of improvisation, looking for the ending or wondering what it was going to be. I really enjoy finding that point of convergence where, oh, these are the elements that go together that I've been looking for, and then the piece usually happens fairly quickly. I create all sorts of secondary or resultant charts and graphs and all sorts of collections of information that I might use in the future, but just the act of creating them often helps me get to the next step. As for why, always on my mind. It's when I'm in it, it's reason in and of itself. Not really looking to for it to serve one function or another. Especially when I was younger and was doing it without commission or whatever. I feel like anyone in my position would follow it too. You know, it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some of the charts and graphs that you create. I've seen some of these charts and graphs. Often in David's life, they are just these endless piles and papers all taped together and sometimes taped together on gallery walls, depending on the project you're working on and where it's being displayed. Everything from handwritten linear notations to sonograms to all these things. And so when we first met, I joked that you were an archivist nightmare because of all the different types of materials you created in the process of creating a piece, but also the sort of interwoven nature of all of them, regardless of what piece you were working on at that moment. Can you speak to that at all, and sort of the secondary materials that you create while creating?
These boxes and boxes I was talking about are they're things that I'd saved up and known I might use in the future. I often know that the answer's in there somewhere for whatever questions or thoughts I had. Really early on, I spent a lot of time just enumerating all the possibilities for, you know, how many chords with four notes are there? How many sounds can a clarinet make? How many possible time signatures are there? And I have an abundance of these things, and I start to see large scale patterns just over time. I'd say that I think my approach is probably akin to dots on a blackboard, and whatever I'm interested in at the time might fall close to something I've done in the past, and it doesn't mean that the next thing I do has to be related to the thing I did before. It's often very different from what I did just before, and I'm often going back and forth, hoping to write new things with regards to what I've made, as well as anyone else. But I think these piles and these boxes and these things are very similar, and I've kind of created a library, and if I can somehow get it organized, of things that I can use, it's kind of my external brain.
Also, I do want to just include one of my favorite anecdotes. So the first night, one of the first nights David and I met, I saw his apartment, which is why I know of these piles. And so all the different types of papers based on, you know, again, like sound waves and compositions by other musicians and articles about music theory and all this stuff were laid out in this very sparse apartment that had nothing else in it really other than all these papers. And in the center you had a big circle of piles of papers, and in the middle of it you had a piece of paper with arrows drawn on it that pointed to the different piles, listing, sort of describing what each pile was. And I was fascinated by it because essentially that was a finding aid, which is a concept and a thing that we use in archives all the time, which is how you explain what materials you will find in a collection. And it was just so fascinating to me to see a finding aid for a living collection of piles of paper on the floor. And it was really lovely.
I've been bugging you ever since to help me organize
it. I will never be your archivist. You need a music archivist. You need somebody who has that skill set. And you do need an archivist. It's just not me. So again, the nice thing about these interviews is that, you know, I have all these very straightforward, explicit questions, but as I notice often happens in the interview is that the questions are touched on without necessarily being explicit sometimes. So the next question I generally ask is, please talk to us about the totality of your body of work and some different themes that have emerged. Mm-hmm. And do you feel there's more you can say on that?
Maybe a little more. I touched on it earlier that it was it's really a number of disconnected points at first that you know I can start to draw lines between once I have written things. You know, that where I'm actually kind of going back and spiraling around different notions, and I think I've always been interested in having no single voice, and it always bothered me that composers seem to be known for their style, and there were so many kinds of music that I was interested in, I'm interested in, that I don't want to choose a style, and so these connections emerge without me having to really think about them and become kind of a landscape. And The more I work with it, the more fluid these things become. These kind of pathways emerge between modes of writing that I had thought completely disconnected. And I do think a lot about you know, music is such a vast term. There are so many different ways for music to be right, and that fascinates me. And how does that happen? What does it mean that music makes sense if you don't understand how it's made? I explore a lot of these things in different ways in the pieces I've written, and I'm still finding new pathways, and but I'd say it's the variety and the information coming from everywhere. I think that there's nothing not worth knowing, and every little bit of your experience can inform, you know, the next work. So
I think an interesting thing too that we haven't talked about is that when it comes to violinists in Buffalo, you are pretty well known, primarily because of your roles in street performing and performing busking, really, during the Allentown Arts Festival, during the Elmwood Arts Festival, pretty much the Farmers Market, just all over the city in this way. So, you know, people come up to you quite often and say, oh, you're the violin guy. So a lot of people have a relationship with you and what you do as a violinist rather than a composer, mm-hmm. because a lot of the music you play in those busking environments is not primarily the music you write.
Yes.
So I think this is very interesting too, because, you know, people who listen to this, who know you as the violin guy, but are hearing about these sort of out there compositions that you do that have a, you know, strong history within 21st century, 20th century musical canon, there's a big disconnect there. Can you speak a little bit about what you do in a busking environment, what you play there, and how those two pieces are related?
Sure. Well, I guess I should backtrack and talk about the history of how I came to start playing outside. And it happened that going to music school as a composition major, I was assumed to play the piano, and that the piano is the composer's instrument. And so for the first 2 years of school, I didn't have lessons. I had nowhere to play. I had, and I liked performing. I was always working on something prior to that as a performer. And I said, well, if I'm not going to do it in school, I'm going to take it outside of school. And so I went to the public library and picked up some new music, some folk music that I really enjoyed, and I started to take it outside, and I wasn't looking for it, but what I found was a kind of experience with the general public that was really rewarding and very eye-opening, and a relationship with an audience that I had never experienced, playing on a stage disconnected from everyone else who was there sitting quietly listening. Outside, people are coming from all directions. People come right up to you, you know, so close they can smell you. You know, it's a different kind of way of interfacing with people, and it teaches you so much that you're not expecting. And these lessons were huge for me. It changed how I played, and it's kind of an instant feedback kind of situation. And I fell in love with it, and the appreciation that I got for certain parts of my repertoire, it helped me craft a whole kind of street repertoire that I still use to this day and trying to refine. And it's actually one of my goals in the future to find that connection between what I play on the street and what I write, and a lot of the things that I write are not catchy, not prone to being immediately understood or appreciated, even as a form of music rather than a form of noise. So it opened up a whole nother avenue for me to be a musician, and I felt like it was worthwhile. I recommend it to any musician. I think that playing in a venue is one thing, and playing outside is a completely separate, a whole nother way of conveying yourself to the public, not for an audience that you choose, who comes knowingly through the doors to listen to something with a certain kind of expectation. They are going from point A to point B, and suddenly you're there in the middle, and that's surprising. And I've gotten some, you know, amazing feedback from different people, the way that they appreciate being given something before being expected to give back, or it flies in the face of a lot of assumptions, and I enjoy that in my compositions, and I enjoy that in performing too. So.
What are some of the types of music you play on the street?
I play a lot of Jewish folk music, klezmer music, gypsy music, transcribed, and a lot of the music that's fun, a lot of fun to play, has not been written down, and I am borrowing a lot of this music. I feel like I put myself into it, and have developed my own style, but I guess, you know, we all start with materials that don't belong to us, you know, until they're our own. So I'm looking for other things to play outside and to kind of break down the barrier between what I play outside, which is often very, very exciting, danceable, virtuosic music, and the more intimate, explorative kinds of works that I write. I think maybe hopefully in a few years I'll start playing things that I wrote outside. I've tried that a couple of times, and I kind of got what I expected. A lot of strange looks and people crossing the street. So.
You mentioned that you play some works that have not been written down, but you transcribe those, mm-hmm. some of them.
Yes.
Right. I see that as like a crossover where your skill set with composition has a practical application of making pre-existing music accessible. Do you see that as a form of creation or just transcription?
It's very technical as far as transcribing, but it's also, I guess, in school and not as a result of being taught it, I realized that I need to learn acoustics. I need to learn how sound actually functions and exists, and that opened me up to all sorts of questions I was asking myself about the way my instrument functions, and I was writing pieces filled with all the sounds I could make on my instrument that I'd never seen in pieces before, and looking at sound and sonograms and understanding the relationship between how these frequencies and these things manifest in the sound that we hear, and seeing these frequency time charts as proto music notation, and I've actually found ways of drawing music notation right on the sonograms, and these translations really they answer a lot of questions. Listening to something in slow motion, to you know, a few notes at a time, just really hearing what's actually there and writing it out. It can never completely be captured, and there are all sorts of nuances and things like that you fill in when you play it, but you don't read it off the page. But there is a lot there, in the gypsy music especially. It goes so fast that you almost don't hear certain things as a string of notes, but more as a sound, and to really get into those worlds without having studied Lautari music or Roma Gypsy music firsthand, to really listen to the sound. Everything sounds like modern music when you slow it down.
Well, this is what's so interesting too, just hearing you describe it like that. So I'm actually thinking of like the painting techniques of Roy Lichtenstein, right? Who's known for doing these sort of like cartoon-esque paintings, right? Where you'd actually take a cartoon strip and take a square of it and paint it as a painting. But apparently when he was actually painting it, he would have the canvas and the cartoon strip upside down, mm-hmm. right? So it just loses all form as understandable representation.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're taking these Roma Gypsy songs that you're transcribing for the first time, and slowing it down to the point where you're listening to three notes at a time and not looking at the composition as a whole, but instead looking so intensely at these small parts, I see a lot of similarities there that don't translate the same way as perhaps visual art does. But then again, you know, unless you know that about Lichtenstein's process, you wouldn't necessarily know that that's part of what he was getting at, which is sort of the removal of meaning
mm-hmm.
from this.
And there is a continuation of that I started to. I've been recently engaged in transcriptions of real world sounds on my instrument, much in the same way as I approach learning these crazy gypsy tunes that I play outside.
So we were talking about transcribing real world sounds.
Mm-hmm.
You did that. One example I can think of you transcribing real world sounds was for the Bird Captures project that you did last year with Julian Montague.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak a little bit about that experience?
Yes. Well, Julian came to visit me in the cafe that I work at, and was telling me about this collection of photographs of all sorts of birds that he'd captured and was hoping to create some kind of sound installation to go along with. And I said, well, I've been playing around with the idea of transcribing things that exist in nature, not necessarily musical sounds, and what do you think if I give it a shot and you give me a list of the birds you've taken pictures of, and I'll see which ones make sounds that I think I might be able to replicate on the instrument, and kind of went from there. And within 2 months, I knew all sorts of things about birds and why they made their sounds, and you know, I kind of went on one of my information gathering expeditions and started to look at these sonograms of bird calls and realized that for some of them I couldn't actually play them at the pitch or the speed that they sang, and so some of them, like for the robin call, I actually am playing four times slower and two octaves lower than they actually sound, and using loop pedals that sped up the sound, bringing it up to speed, and the compositions, I mean, they're compositions in that I tried to map some kind of sense of the grammar of how these birds communicate on large sheets of paper, and using kind of modular approach where you'll have a few bars written with arrows pointing to the different possible paths that they can take, judged from recordings where I've heard sounds in succession, and just it took a lot of figuring out how to make these sounds happen on my instrument, but I've come up with a collection of maybe 8 so far, and I'd like to do it in the future. I tried to take from birds indigenous in the area that people would recognize, and so it wouldn't be so difficult to identify if indeed they sounded like the birds I was going for. So it was a really fascinating experience and a real collaboration. It really felt collaborative what we ended up with. His works were huge in people receiving what I was there to do. I'd never had an audience listen so intently to what I was doing and why I was doing it, and the grounding in the real world really brought people into this very exotic kind of sound world that a lot of them had not been exposed to, and I was even able to display a lot of the materials I used in writing the work. So there, it was ideal as far as presenting a new work, and I think it coming from real world sounds really brought it all the way around, where it was something unfamiliar, but went into making something familiar. So that was very exciting for me, and I've continued to search for more sound sources and different subjects to do these transcriptions, and say they're inspired by some practices more found in painting than in music, which is hyper-realistic representations, which actually kind of go beyond just the mere recreation of something to adding another layer of context, and this juxtaposition between it sounding like a real thing, but also being removed and changed by being the sound of a violin as well as the sound it's trying to create, these in between spaces that at least I get from hearing it, and it's got a lot of possibilities, and I'm definitely not done exploring those avenues.
Speaking of paintings, another project that you worked on more recently was the Resounding Roar compositions that was actually part of the exhibition here at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center. Well, I don't want to touch on that too much because I don't know if you're aware yet, but in December, you and the rest of the musicians will be sitting down with me for a group interview about what that experience was like. Hmm. But when you mentioned sort of thinking of painting techniques and how you apply that, is there anything you'd like to add about sort of like that experience of essentially playing interpretations of Birchfield's paintings based on John Cage's I Ching chance notation?
Well, I think I tend to think there's as much as there's such a great variety in how I mentioned there's many different points and things that I'd like to consider in my musical world. I think there is something underlying, and I think I'm always chasing it, and that kind of brings it all together, that it all is connected, that the mediums really do inform themselves. I mean, we understand music often in terms of color, and understand painting in terms of musical terms, and we have to use these metaphors to really understand these things. And I think when you play so much with going back and forth, so one of those projects was Birchfield's impression of listening to Wagner's opera, which was then taken from the visual impression that Birchfield gave and made back into music, and which sounded nothing like Wagner's operas, but and I don't think there's a direct correspondence. I don't think there's a real way to directly interpret something visual into something aural or vice versa, but the underlying impression of the essence, I think is often called, of the work, I feel like can be expressed in many different ways. Actually, one of the earlier pieces I wrote was my reflection to a painting by Philip Guston before he started to do figural things. He was into these vast color fields, and it was a painting that just hit me, and I didn't really understand anything about it, but I wanted to write a piece of music that explored that painting, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, okay, maybe this color corresponds to this note, and maybe this pattern corresponds to this kind of sound, and I ended up throwing it all away and sitting down and writing the piece in a day, just as a true reaction to the piece. I realized I couldn't recreate the piece in sound, but I could recreate my impression of experiencing the piece, and that really was the seed that brought me to this piece of music that I wrote, which ends. It starts out fully written and slowly lets go of different parameters until the end of the piece is completely improvised, and so I think, while not completely direct, and while I don't think there's a way to accurately that accuracy has anything to do with these interpretations, I think it's always important to count yourself in the experience of a work of art. That's really where you can be coming from, and in order to get that real relationship between mediums.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about your creative process? I feel like we've touched on it very well. But the one sort of things some of the things that I was hearing as you were talking about some of the supplementary materials you create in your process, and also what I've noticed from what I've seen of your work, is the influence of, that your supplementary materials are very quantitative. And they're very mathematical and scientific. So even as you're writing these very emotional pieces, there seems to be importance of these underlying structures and rules and things like that, even when you're picking them apart.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about that?
Well, I think there are tools in your toolbox when you're going to create something, and if you have nothing if you have no vision to, you know, to use them, all the tools don't really matter. But to know something about the harmonic series, and to know that these ratios inform all sorts of aspects of the music, that music can be looked at as a series of overlapping waves at many different levels, some of which are heard as pitch, others which are heard as timbre higher up on the frequency spectrum, and below the sensation of pitch is where rhythm exists, and beyond that you have phrase and then movement form. To understand all the ways that whatever instrument you're writing for can, all the things that it can do, what you know, what's within the realm of possibility for that. I often start sculpturally, in that I start with everything and kind of whittle it down. My writing is often that same way. I think that pervades many aspects of my personality, so I have a lot to say, but getting to the point is usually what takes the most time. So I think all of these different ways of looking at things are useful, but I'm always, I'd say in the beginning I was interested in enumerating the possibilities, but now that I have just a ton of information on every aspect that I know of, I'm looking for those connections, those things that bring together various aspects, and I think there are some real connections. Like learning about the harmonic series was huge, and the use of math, mathematics was big with me ever since I heard the music of Xenakis, and you know, realized that large concepts can be explained mathematically, that a lot of our interactions are mathematical, and that doesn't make math, it doesn't make them any more dry. It's actually exciting that that we think with these things without realizing it, and that there is something spiritual to even the most technical way of approaching something, that they aren't at odds with each other.
Thanks. So the questions from here on out, I see as relating to another aspect of what you do as a artist in Buffalo. And I say in Buffalo very intentionally. One of the next, actually I'm skipping a question, but I'll come back to that question. One of the next questions I ask has to do with the more public side of it. What have you done personally to advance your career in the arts? And I'm not trying to lead you, but I do want to talk about your role with the Infringement Festival. Because that is a project that you are deeply involved with, that I'm also involved with as well, David and I are both co-organizers of the Infringement Festival. In fact, he's one of the people who dragged me into it, though I have certainly taken it and in my own direction. But in some ways, what you do with infringement is composing with the city as your canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of why I am bringing it in here, because I do see it as another aspect of composing that you do. So can you speak a little bit about your role with infringement and what infringement is?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that. So it's very much where I would go with it, what the act of organizing is for me. I guess I can connect it to my street performing, and before I was involved, it was a huge part of what's great about living in Buffalo is this all-inclusive festival that celebrates every kind of art, every manner of expression. There's no entrance. It's just extremely fair, and is an alternate system that it's a needed alternative to the business aspect of being an artist in the city, and it's kind of a celebration of creativity that doesn't take advantage of the people celebrating it, and it creates community in very real ways. There's so much to be said about it. I think there are interviews where I talk about it existing elsewhere, but coming to want to be more involved in it, I knew a lot about street performing, and I knew a lot about what it is to present to an unknowing public, and a lot of those things I learned from what make it work, because street performing, if you're turned 90 degrees in the wrong direction, that might mean that might make or break whether or not that's a good place to play, or whether or not people actually listen to you. And so I learned a lot of rules of how the street works, and how people operate outside. And I said, well, the open busking things that happen outside don't really work, and it's a huge festival, but people can't see it anywhere because a lot of it happens inside. So I want to create an outdoor component that, for one, places artists in a situation that I think is really beneficial and rewarding, and to also bring it out in the open and beautify the city with this this thing that existed before me. I'm really kind of bring public, the idea of public performing, to another level for myself, not just as a performer, but as someone who might know a thing or two about putting people in the best possible place for them to be received in such a situation. I just kind of jumped in and noticed that there were 140 different acts that had applied that said they might be interested in playing outside, and so I gave them all a show, and by the next year I was talking to people in the city and the police chief and all sorts of people because of how successful it had been, and always looking for new ways to approach it, and I think there's a lot of promise to the idea that we as artists don't have to just be confined to a shrinking number of venues that may or may not be appropriate for what we have to offer. There's no, I guess if there are outside, there's nowhere expected, so anything is technically something that can work if framed in the right way, and a lot of it is context and how it's curated, and so it's a big mental exercise that's it's got its own kind of life beyond what I do with it. And I think the festival would happen whether or not we organized it at all, but it's a cooperative effort that really reveals the strands of thought going on in the city in any given year, and I think there's just so much to it, and I'm glad to be in the position to make changes and to make an impact like this.
Can you speak in other ways about what you've done personally to advance your career in the arts in Buffalo? I brought up infringement as an example of one way in which I know you've seen some very tangible increases in people's awareness about you. Mm-hmm. But can you speak to some other things that you have actively done that's influenced your career as a musician in Buffalo?
Well, playing outside really got my name out there, and I think the work with the Infringement Festival allowed me to talk to so many different venues and heads of different organizations that were inaccessible to me without the backing of the reputation of the Infringement Festival, and just reaching out to organizations that that have a stake in the community and in artistic life in Buffalo, and meeting different artists. There are a number of different circles in Buffalo, and ways of bringing them together are very fruitful, and a lot of my programming attempts to do that and bring together groups, different audiences that I think should know each other, and just acting on the desire for more community really brings it about, and Other than that,
what about some of the bands that you've played with?
I've played with a few bands at this point. The first band was with a friend, Paul Kozlowski, who wrote the music for Casper Is Fine. He introduced me to some musicians that I'd go on and play with or form relationships with, and one of my first experiences trying to create my own music was for the Infringement Festival before I was really an organizer. It was an attempt to take the music of Bartok and as a social experiment see what happens when you play it on the street to an unknowing public. And people started to dance to it, as we expected, and we fleshed out these very short children's pieces written during the Great Depression, using two electric violins and drum kit, and created full band textures out of it, and named it after some ancient Hittite king who had a really funny name that we thought was a good expression of the obscure, hard to predict style of music that we were playing.
So what was
that
name?
A band called Shubaluliuma, the greatest Hittite king. Along with other funny band names like Mainata Brahma, which is an Indian term that I think translates to divine sound or God in sound. That's music written by Ravi Padmanabha, a very esteemed local musician. And that's a quartet that takes these themes that Ravi wrote, and almost like a jazz tune where you have a head and then there's improvisation and then you return to the head, but the members in the group really brought it into the many directions that it takes during performance. Our tunes are never the same, I've been involved with just a number of projects, and thankfully have been invited to play with different groups. I just played with Elliot Sharp with the Buffalo Improvisers Orchestra, organized by Steve Bachkowski. I'm pretty open to most ventures and thinking about, you know, new bands and things like that. But I think what Buffalo lacks is people from outside coming in to see all the things being created in Buffalo. A lot of the crowds in Buffalo at the shows are also musicians themselves, or, you know, they're many of the same people, and it's really great to have their support, but we all work in the various local shops in the area, and you know, we almost forget what everyone can do because we see each other all the time, and figuring out different ways to bring people into the city to see what it has to offer is one of the hard problems that trying to address and think about, and so I think those are the things that really the scene could use, as well as standing up and recognizing that it is a scene and the various different avenues and groups in the city do have something in common, and that they can all stand behind that, and the need to really recognize each other as creative individuals. Being on the cover of the Art Voice was really helpful to get people to notice what I do, but there's only so much that can be done without that outside influx of a crowd to recognize that the city has an artistic identity, whatever it is at the time. So I've got a lot of notice in the city of Buffalo, but the question is how do you further that? How do you bridge connections? Using things like the Infringement Festival as a way to bridge boundaries, to talk to different scenes popping up in throughout the country or wherever, that's a good vehicle for creating this discussion of creating a larger sense of being an artistic community, and that can cross the boundaries of geographical boundaries of the rural space between large cities and things like that. I think those things are helpful, and just a general embracing of creative organizations and movements that may be different from what you're doing or what anyone, you know, what other people are doing, but realizing that we're all doing it for more recognition for the importance that it plays in life, that is readily visible in the positive effects that it can have on the community that we see every year during the festival, but you know that only goes so far as the ways in which it's noticed by the community or written about or what it results in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you did a great job of answering the question I didn't even ask about your needs as an artist that the larger community can provide. For where you are now, what would help advance your artistic career in Buffalo or beyond Buffalo?
It's often skill sets that I probably would have to spend a lot of time to develop and learning how to advertise myself, but not using the same tactics as advertisers. I think the difference between advertising something like the Infringement Festival and advertising a product that's going to break is, you know, as soon as the warranty is up, is that there's something actual, and it's not not trying to sell anything, but it's that I know it has value, and I think kind of sidetracking, but I think it would be a way to network, to reach large communities, a way to create that larger network that I know exists beyond the circles of people with like interests. And a broader sense that it's not a culture of scarcity, that it's not everyone competing for the same resources. It's that the more we help each other, the more everyone benefits as a result of it. That's what the Infringement Festival really does. It creates a shared legitimacy or sense of something to tie together all sorts of voices that would be very small and disparate from each other without that. And I think hearing about things like the Barge Project, that's really exciting because it gets people thinking about what's our identity as a as an artistic community, and talks about identity and really fleshing out, you know, what are our common interests, what are things that we need, that we all need, and I'd like to see those conversations start happening, especially as development happens and places that used to be artistic neighborhoods are suddenly worth a lot in property value, and the future of these artistic circles is uncertain. You know, for there to be more continuation from the many really great things that happen in Buffalo, that often fall, that often happen and go by and are quickly forgotten. How that looks, I don't know. But some kind of sense of equity for artists who put a lot into what they do, and I mean, you can only put so much into it. If you're just doing it by yourself, what I learned from the Infringement Festival is you don't, most of the time you don't need money if the resources are there. And that we have a lot of resources in the community, and it's about utilizing these resources in a way that everyone can benefit from. And I'd like to see more local attempts to mobilize these resources, and all kinds of resources, you know. Artists are resources in and of themselves, and spaces that aren't being used for much of anything, or that no one thinks about, they can be utilized and shared. Things that would help more education in the general public of what artistic life is and what our artistic ideas are going around, and more of an appreciation for those artists who put themselves outside and are doing their thing, so, you know, so it can become part of the cultural life and not just an anomaly. I'd like to think that what I'm doing is encouraging other people to go out there and be creative in a public space as an alternate model. I too often do people play shows that cost them more to prepare than they get out of it. And the good thing about Buffalo is that a lot of people do create because they love to. The unfortunate part is they create because they love to, because there's not much else they get out of it often. And it's just some way to strike the balance, so that artists can continue to be artists, and don't have to fold under the economic strain.
I will say, from knowing you, I can think of one other thing that you need, which is a database, right?
Well, more ways for artists to organize information would be huge. You know, in a lot of ways, I don't even know you know, the avenues out there to be used, you know, that would be really helpful. A database would be excellent. Do I go to school for programming to understand all the things I need to know about how to structure data the way that I know that it needs to be useful? You know, those things, they take a lot of time, but if there's, you know, if there's some way for artists to make use of these resources, if they're available, that'd be great. That'd be more than I would even know to ask for.
David, so this question I normally ask, I ask, what advice do you have for emerging artists? And I think that you could probably speak on that very well. But another alternative to that, for some people, that's too broad to... excuse me. For some people, that's too broad and too vague. And so some people prefer me to ask, what advice would you give yourself when you were starting your career as a musician or as an artist? So whichever variation on that you'd like to answer.
Well, I think I'm on the track that I think I'd like to be. I don't have too many regrets as far as how I developed, and I think it's remaining open to the potentials that you don't you to know that you that to know that you don't know what's out there, and to always be open as a result, because I could not, and I think I knew this in the beginning, and it remains true now, that I never knew what I wanted to see myself doing in the future, but I always knew that proceeding honestly with myself, I would get to something that was meaningful, and I wouldn't have seen it as playing on the street or organizing large art festivals or anything like that. But I think remaining open and finding strands of yourself and things that you haven't experienced yet or haven't come across yet is very valuable. Might be the most important, and to learn how to teach yourself.
So now the question we will close on, you have already touched on in different ways, but what do you hope to achieve with your art, with your music, and with your presence?
Well, that's not what gets me sitting down and writing music or anything, but I'd like to see that it surprises other people as something beautiful that they didn't think was possible, in the same way that I chase musical ideas because I believe that they're possible, but I don't know that they exist yet. And I think to show that being an artist comes in many different forms, some of which don't have a clear relation to each other, but that those connections will be borne out in time, that there is something important, even to the most obscure interests you find yourself drawn to. That it's worth some, that it's worth sharing, and that it's worth bringing to attention, regardless of what you think people feel about it or have any interest in it. Just show that that experience is only worth so much, and that art is open to anyone, and that personally my favorite impressions of my work are from people who claim to have no musical knowledge whatsoever. The fact that that music kept in the music schools and the conservatories and things like that are in danger of being kept away from those who wouldn't know that they get something out of it, that that all art is worth sharing because you don't know what effect it will have on those who don't know to look for it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we conclude the interview, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Go, Bernie.
David, thank you so much for coming in today to be interviewed as part of the Living Legacy Project. This has been really wonderful.
I think so too.
And we will continue to hear from you in different avenues, both throughout the Birchfield world and Buffalo in general. And everyone, do come out for the Infringement Festival next year. This will probably be released right around the time of Infringement next year. So maybe we'll see if we can get that done.
All right.
Okay.